Day, and many of us are enjoying the lovely weather here at Old Village. My name is Petter Jothen. I teach religion at St. Olaf College. And this week I'm enjoying having conversations about sort of the tensions and sort of challenges of both being called as Christians, but also being called as a citizen of a particular nation state. And the last 2 days we've looked at flag as a symbol, using sort of thinking about the symbolic nature of civic religion. And yesterday we thought a little bit about how we can use our political language within, or our religious language within the political realm. And today I want to think about the order of things. And I know that's kind of a big title, and it can mean lots of different things. And there are actually many favorite famous books called The Order of Things. But I want to think about it in a couple ways. One, that we crave order. That we as humans, both individually, we want order within ourselves, but we all want order without. And so we've had to come to terms with the fact that we need to figure out how to make decisions. And what that has required of us is that we form, at least for us, in our context, we form something we call a politics, a government, a nation state. And what I want to think about today is sort of the deeper underlying question about why. And in particular, think about some of the ways that Christian tradition has said, okay, we need to figure out a way to live in this world, in this material creation, in God's created creation. And in order to do that, we have to have some way of making choices. Well, what authorizes our political system? What legitimates our political system? What gives the order of things legitimacy? And that's sort of the question I want to think about. And it's a big question, and I certainly don't expect us to solve it. My hope is that we'll just think about creative ways that we as Christians engage and participate in the life of our democracy. And I also want to sort of complexify it a little bit, because in many ways, the Christian tradition that we've inherited, and we're going to talk about Luther, well, my intention is to talk about Luther, a little bit of Paul, and Romans, and Reinhold Niebuhr, the three of them. But we'll see if we have time. And I'm glad, again, to sort of just enjoy a conversation with you all about these kinds of topics. But what does a tradition that, in a lot of ways, especially Paul, but in a lot of ways, is thinking about our ultimate future, which is not of this earth. It's not of this place. You know, whenever we think of heaven, we as Christians use that kind of language to say that's where we really belong, whatever that might mean. So as a consequence, political life has always been sort of relativized, sort of a stepson, if you will, of Christian life. And we start to see that pretty much right from the start in terms of Paul's letter to the Romans. And this is a rather influential and important text. It's been commented by many great minds. But I just want to spend a little bit of time sort of thinking about what Paul is doing here and what it means for us when it comes to our political life. Shall I read it? Or do you want to?
Sure.
Let every person be subject to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God. And those authorities that exist have been instituted by God. Therefore, whoever resists authority resists what God has appointed. And those who resist will incur judgment. For rulers are not a terror to good conduct, but to bad. Do you wish to have no fear of the authority? Then do what is good, and you will receive its approval. For it is God's servant for your good. But if you do what is wrong, you should be afraid, for the authority does not bear the sword in vain. It is the servant of God to execute wrath on the wrongdoer. Therefore, one must be subject, not only because of wrath, but also because of conscience. For the same reason you also pay taxes, for the authorities are God's servants, busy with this very thing. And there's obviously a lot here. You know, there's the conscience, there's wrath. But the question I want to ask is, okay, how does this help us make sense of our political system? What do you think Paul is telling us about the purpose of our nation state and our government?
Is he speaking to us? I mean, he was speaking to a different
time. Sure.
So, you know, it certainly probably could apply to us, but is there something that he was saying that was in context at that time that would have been more applicable?
Sure. I mean, obviously one way to read this text is to place it within Paul's context. I'm preferring a read or a way of interpreting that says, okay, Paul is a touchstone for us as Christians in terms of a tradition that authorizes certain types of institutions. And this text has been used by, among others, Martin Luther, to authorize a certain understanding of the role of government. Yeah?
It's also been used by people who are, say, opposed to liberation theology to basically tell people to to stop agitating
Turkey. Why? Why does it tell us to stop agitating?
I think it's because it's saying that there is a purpose to having a authority and a government because that authority's job is to make a right and just order of things. And so I guess it would be great if there was a clause in here that said as long as the authority is in fact doing what it kind of assumes that it's doing, then that'd be nice, but we don't have that here, unfortunately.
Well, we also you use two words that aren't in here.
Which two words?
Right and just.
But there's bad and good, though.
For rulers are not a terror to good conduct. What's good conduct? But to bad.
Heather?
Yeah, Julie. Really open.
In ancient Greek, you know, the descriptions of Hesiod and Homer, mm-hmm. The impression that I got from, because they also kind of admonish the members of society to abide by the rules, and very, very sternly, you know, presenting those rules as the expression of the manifestation of, you know, the gods' will, and my impression was that in those societies, right, because they, you know, their economic foundation was relatively poor, right, mm-hmm. Those societies could disintegrate relatively easily if people didn't do the functions that were assigned to them. If people rebelled, then the dangers for each member of those societies, those communities, could be... I'm talking about before the classical period of, you know, Greek,
sure.
Ancient civilization.
Sure.
And it's very adamant, the tone of, you know, we have to follow the rules, you know, because the punishment is not only the, you know, the earthly punishment, but also, you know, the ire, the fury of the gods is going to fall upon you, that kind of thing. And that's just the impression that I had. And I wonder, you know, this is more, you know, Roman Empire period, right? But I wonder if still there is something about that.
Well, I think you raise a good point. I'm hoping we're following this. Is A, where does the government come from? The political come from? It's instituted by God. It doesn't tell us what kind of government. It doesn't specify democracy, a republic, a representational parliamentarian system. It doesn't tell us any of those things. It does tell us, though, that there's a political order that is instituted by God. And what is our duty as Christian citizens? Our duty is to obey that system that God has instituted. And obviously, that's not a very sophisticated reading. But I want to point out that that's part of the tension of this tradition that we've inherited as Christians in terms of what Christianity specifies when it comes to the political. Michael?
Does Paul follow his own counsel?
No.
No way.
So then, you know, doesn't that kind of bring into question exactly what he's saying here in terms of at least on the one hand he's saying, you know, don't be a wrongdoer but you know, Paul's actions in Philippi got him thrown into jail and all kinds of things, but was he a wrongdoer? So in that sense, if you're not a wrongdoer, is there a sense that you indeed do not obey the authorities?
I think that's a great point. And I think you're pointing out some of the tensions in terms of how we can interpret this text. I think the issue that I'm trying to sort of push us on is the fact that ultimately, when we get to Martin Luther, we have him worried about something. And maybe this is the better way to sort of do with what I'm trying to do. I just wanted to show you a picture of a horse's ass. Anyone know how to make this work?
What are you trying to do?
It's a movie.
Comment, maybe?
Press down the bottom left-hand corner so
yeah.
Try to
yeah, but it just...
Yeah. Go to the slide. Go to screen.
But if... This worked on my computer.
Can you double-click on it?
Yeah, maybe that, yeah, because he allows you to do it.
This worked for me when I set this up.
When actually does this picture represent?
Well, it's from the Luther movie, and I'll set this up. This is a sort of a dramatization of the... Maybe this would work.
Is this a different computer?
No, this is my computer.
Click the little question box there.
Fine movie.
Yeah, it seems to
play Gandalf.
I don't know what that
movies. Recent places movies.
Yeah, I don't think it would be. I think it's in.
It's got your name
about
on
play
it.
Play slideshow.
Hold on.
Or are you playing the slideshow? Mm-hmm.
Have you tried dropping it on the floor?
Have you tried?
Oh, here we go. There we go.
There
it
is.
I know I was there, but
is the volume on too?
Yeah. The cord wasn't set up when I got here, so I didn't have a chance. Did I already destroy
it?
It
was a movie.
Yeah.
I apologize. This worked for me when I set it up. Oh, there we go.
Okay.
Rebels were outside God's law, but nothing on earth is more poisonous, hurtful, or devilish than a rebel, but they must be stopped by every means possible.
Can you see this?
And yet, the blood they shed is as nothing compared to this slaughter I have unleashed.
Yes. It's over. How many? No one knows yet. How many? Some say 50,000. Some 100. 100,000. Dead peasants. There were knights of mine. That's a plague spider. That's butcher. And I care about him. And they need these butchers.
That's from the Luther movie, which I know is, I'll get back to where I was with that one. That no historian is actually sure how many people were killed. The movie infers about 100,000.
So what was this? Was this a peasant rebellion?
This is the peasant rebellion, or peasant war, which I think occurred in the first half of the 1500s. And Luther was at this point being protected by a duke in Saxony. And he, of course, was arguing that people should be able to read the Bible for themselves. He was countering the papal authority. And at the same time that was going on, he sort of was protected by the political authorities. And as a result, there was both this, what we would say, sort of tension between religious authority and political authority. The political authorities were sort of using Luther to influence and gain their own power against Rome, as Luther was doing the same thing. The problem was, is that it sort of opened a can of worms. And that can of worms was that the peasants were led by a number of other types of Christian leaders, including a guy named Munster. I know you brought him up the other day. And what Munster believed was that the Spirit revealed ongoing, through dreams and other sort of revelations, Christian truth. So outside of the institutional church, outside of the Catholic Church. And Munster gained a following. And they revolted against the powers that be. And the peasant war was sort of the consequence of that. And so Luther here, in this particular clip, shows up and sees sort of the consequences of his theology. And as a result, he actually authorizes the use of the sword. Violence. Power. It's authorized because of sin. And so what he says is that the sword is most beneficial and necessary for the whole world in order to preserve peace, punish sin, and restrain the wicked. But he also says no Christian shall wield or invoke the sword for himself in his cause. In behalf of another, he may and should wield it and invoke it to restrain wickedness and to defend godliness. So on the one hand, he authorizes the political powers that be, and he uses Romans 13 to justify this. To more or less kill those who are preventing proper Christian order. He thinks it's vital that that happens. And by doing so, he sort of establishes a norm for the political. And that norm is the use of violence to ensure peace. And that's it. It's not about justice. It's not about freedom. It's not about liberty. It's not about the common good. I mean, it's a very minimal definition of what a political institution is supposed to be. And this is the tradition that a lot of ethicists still wrestle with. Because you have this Pauline text that we could read in a lot of different ways, but has been used to justify the powers that be.
Including Hitler.
Including Hitler. John, were you gonna...
I just... Bush doctrine is just running through my head. Strike first to prevent bad things from happening. This is almost a justification for preemptive strike.
Other thoughts?
So yesterday we... This has been something that's been bugging me since we started this line of conversation. You have yesterday's example of Goshen College and the Mennonites. Very clearly pacifistic, very clearly anti-establishment. It's part of the sort of core of their existence, right? You have the Westboro Baptist Church. The notion that there is a unified Christian sense around this stuff is something that I've been struggling with because you've got Luther saying that this is okay, you've got the Mennonites saying not so much, and the Amish drawing from some of the same texts. You have Westboro Baptist Church with their own particular spin on government, good, bad, and different. So the notion of a singular Christian relationship to government is something I'm really having a hard time getting my head around, because clearly within the group of people that identify themselves as Christians, not so much with the consensus, and clearly cherry picking the texts.
Yeah. And a Jewish comment from a book of the Mishnah called Pirkei Avot says, pray for the welfare of the authorities, since for the lack of vector of men, and this is what it says, I'm sorry for the sexism, would eat each other alive, which sounds very much like what Paul says. But on the other hand, we do have the ancient, what Judaism started as basically a revolt against authority. What do you think going forth from Egypt was? Mm-hmm. It was a revolt against authority. Was the first labor strike in history.
I'll back up just one other, just sort of out of order for some reason too, but underneath what Luther was doing too, and this is still, like for instance, if you go to the Synod website, it talks about religion at Synod, and they use two kingdoms here. And two kingdoms is sort of the fundamental theological touchstone for Luther's theology that has influenced those within the Lutheran tradition. And really, we are part of two kingdoms. We as Christians are part of the kingdom of God. And through the kingdom of God, God governs through the gospel of love. Love, commandments, and forgiveness. And for Luther, the primary locus point of this kingdom is inside of us. It's in our heart. But all of us are part of the world, where God governs the world through human law. Because sin is so powerful that if we did not have human law, A, we wouldn't be able to even form as Christians, because we would do exactly what you're suggesting is kill each other. I mean, it's a very sort of low view of human nature. Luther's very worried about things.
Hobbesian, you might say?
Yeah, pre-Hobbesian. I mean, directed... The of the world is directed then at outward, external behavior. So Luther, again, is really concerned about what we're going to do to each other if we don't have the sword telling us kind of keeping us in line. Earlier on, when he was doing this, he was much more optimistic about Christians. That once they would hear the word of God, that truly they would form, and eventually through grace, be able to exhibit this gospel of love and this forgiveness of sins throughout their whole life. But as the movie sort of portrays, it doesn't happen. So he even develops this sort of the worldness even more robustly. Because he is so worried. And the real point I'm sort of pushing here is, if we think about our expectation of what our government does, you know, what do we receive from, in particular, the U.S. government? I know not all of us are Americans here, but what do we expect to receive from our government?
Services.
Services. What kind of services?
Protection.
Protection, okay.
Education.
Roads.
Safe food.
Yeah.
People like me would say health, at least some kind of healthcare coverage. That's our majority so far seem to think that that's not necessary.
What else?
Protection from crime and violence.
Okay, protection from violence, sure.
Protection, international aid.
Sure. Well, think about our global economy. You know, a lot of rhetoric nowadays is about globalization and economic competitiveness, and we need to increase our investments in certain types of technologies to compete on the world stage. So, for instance, our president is talking about, guess what, investing in renewable energy sources because he wants to ensure the American economy remains current with trends in the economic future. I mean, all those things are good, I think, for most of us. And even the, I know we talked a lot about this yesterday, even the right-wingers don't completely want to get rid of, for instance, the Department of Education. Some of them do, but not all of them. Does Luther's idea of government have anything to do with a government that does more than just protects us using the sword?
It would appear not.
But it does say governs the world through human law, and that would indicate that there is the ability within cultures, societies, to set up options on what the government will do. So it certainly can go beyond that. Restrained sin is one of those things.
Sure. Yeah.
It seems very, both this definition and the other one you popped up from Luther seem very dependent on sin, both in terms of how you're going to define it, and if there's going to be a sort of hierarchy of which sins are the worst. Right? So that it seems like for him, sort of the worst sin would be to kill someone or something like that, and that we have to stop that, right? But that he's less worried about, or both this one and Paul seem less worried about how the authorities themselves might sin by being granted the authority. So that they're, does that make any sense?
I think what you're, Dick, do you want to?
Well, I was just going to say when I read restrain sin, I read that to mean that there are, you talk about the hierarchical thing, but okay, let's say the sin of cheating, the sin of exclusion, the sin of da-da-da-da-da-da. And so there are a whole bunch of things that would be other than just killing. That may fall into a hierarchical situation, but certainly including other, in quotes, sins or shortcomings of Christian behavior.
But yeah, I guess that like partly that it becomes dependent on the authorities themselves to decide what sin is exactly and which sins are the ones that are supposed to be sort of taken under their jurisdiction, which seems like that allows quite a bit of wiggle room for the authorities, I guess.
But it is a lot of wiggle room. I mean, I don't, Luther, the part of the frustration with Luther is he was not a systematic thinker. He sort of dealt with problems as they arose, which meant, in some ways, he's more pragmatic than one would like if you're trying to develop a whole system of thought from his corpus. And as a consequence, it means that it can be read lots of different ways. I mean, I mean how many forms of Lutheranism are there in this country of ours? What?
ELCA and the Mose Synod.
Yeah, and then there's Wisconsin Synod, there's Lutheran Church of the Brethren, there's a Missouri Synod. Yeah, and then at the NELC, North American Lutheran Church, that is sort of forming out of the ELCA. I mean, there's lots of debates over, A, what important Luther is, but also how we define ourselves as Lutherans. Because of sort of the way Luther did what he did.
Probably more than any other person. He probably wasn't as clear as Calvin or something.
Well, he wasn't as clear as Calvin,
no,
that's for sure.
No, that's for sure.
But it is, Kate, I think you bring up a point, it is about sin. And for him, for Luther, the primary sin is pride. Thinking that you are greater than God. And Luther believes that every other sin flows from that original sin, so to speak, that all of us participate in. I know you were the Augustine. Luther was an Augustinian monk. So pride, self-love, becomes the root of all other sins. And Luther's real point, though, is that ultimately, how can we love each other if we walk out the door and we get our heads chopped off? I mean, it's battle stations here. And that's what government is for. But it's not very robust, is it, definition of what government? Or really adhered very well to our current context, I think, either. And I think that's part of the problem we face, I think, as Christians. And I think you bring up a good point, too, Sean, with the fact that different forms of Christianity have lots of different ideas about what the government is and should be.
Two additional thoughts. One, Luther was writing while divine right of kings was still a prevailing thought of how government formed, that the ruling nobility were granted that right by God. It wasn't, the common man didn't have voice. And I wasn't aware, but you pointed out that he was under the protection of people whose nobility came directly from God in their minds. And so there's a skewing in terms of applying Luther's thought about government to a government that is not granted through divine right, which is what he was living under. And then had the founding fathers paid close attention to your quote from Romans, the revolution never would have occurred, and we wouldn't be having the conversation.
Well, the founding fathers weren't... Anyone know the history of the founding fathers?
No, a lot of them at least were, even though a lot of them were Episcopalian church members, at least the ones coming from Virginia, a lot of them also were basically deists who basically believed that God bound it up and then said, let it go. And a lot of them also were members of the Masonic movement, which at that time, nowadays, everybody thinks it's just another one of those social clubs. But at that time, it was revolutionary. Basically, it was against kings. It was very much against the way the Catholic Church dominated in Europe. And people like Mozart were a member.
I didn't know Mozart was a Mason.
the whole magic flute opera, which I just saw for this, I don't know how many of time in Seattle, but is based on Masonic.
Of his Bible. In fact, I think you can buy a Jefferson Bible. What he did is he cut up every part of the Bible he didn't think, and it was just, I think it was just the Gospels. He cut up every part he didn't think Jesus said, or event of Jesus' life that he didn't think happened, including the resurrection.
He was following Luther in that. And then Luther wanted the book of James read out of the New Testament as well.
Yeah, I think Luther later in life changed that.
Well, it's like you say, he wasn't systematic.
Right. So. And he didn't like, Luther didn't like Revelation either. He thought Revelation was all law and no good news. So he was frustrated with Revelation. But Jefferson cut up the Bible and really thought Jesus was just like Socrates. In fact, Jefferson was one of the leading proponents of de-establishing the Anglican Church in Virginia, which was the state church of Virginia. So, there are other views of government, and one of them is the Catholic tradition. This is from 1963, and that the Catholic tradition believes that authority must seek to promote the common good for all. That is the reason for its existence. And the Catholic Church believes, ultimately, that all of us are endowed with natural reason. Because we can think. I know that seems sort of curt, but all of us can reason. And what Catholic thought believes is that ultimately that participates in God's mind. And that because our thinking ability participates in God's mind, that ultimately when we create a government, for instance, it participates in God's order of things. So as a consequence, if an authority is going to be just, it has to work well with God's law. Not human law, like Luther talks about. And ultimately it's about the common good. They don't use Romans. They use a very metaphysical idea of who we are. And it's also true that one of the big differences between the Catholic tradition and the Protestant tradition in general is the fact that Catholics don't have the same view of sin as, for instance, Lutherans do. Luther was petrified of sin. He viewed us as rascals. That nothing we could do was ever good enough. Catholics believe, ultimately, that Christianity perfects us, but that we have good in us. Luther believes only Christ can bring out the good in us, and it's by completely denying ourselves that that is made possible. That's the only way we can love each other, is by self-denial. So it's a very different attitude of the political sphere. Very different justification. Is this making some sense? I feel like it's... It is kind of warm here. Right?
I'm still thinking of Jefferson.
Yeah.
Cutting up his Bible. The problem is that there is a page behind.
It was before Whiteout.
And way before Delete.
Yeah, that's true. And the last thing I want to look at, and hopefully this will resonate with us a little bit more too, primarily because this is Barack Obama's favorite theologian. Reinhold Niebuhr. And Reinhold Niebuhr was a pastor originally. He was a pastor in Detroit when in the 20s and 30s there were lots of labor riots. And he sort of was worried. He was worried about sin too. He thought humans were sinful creatures. It comes out of the Protestant tradition. And the problem with sin is that humans crave power. We want power. We want control. And it gets worse the more of us you put together. So for those of you who work in institutions, you might concur there. The harder decisions, the harder it is to make decisions, the bigger the group that you have. Because different people want power. And for Niebuhr, that's sin. But Niebuhr also had a sort of robust definition of democracy. But he was really worried, too. He felt, for Christians, that the true source of authority, the true good, the true legitimacy, the true order of things, comes from God. In fact, it is God. God gives us a sense of power, gives us a sense of authority, gives us a sense of identity. And ultimately, our worth then as humans is because we are images of God. Imago Dei. Our worth as humans is beyond then the political and the world. He, unlike Luther, though, thought we had freedom, radical freedom. We can both create beautiful things, but more importantly, we can destroy them. In fact, ultimately, if we're all out there craving power, the issue becomes that we're closing in on our destruction. Because sin penetrates all our hopes and our dreams and our actions, our quest for power, our self-interest. He also felt that the problem with most political ideologies is that they are utopian. So if you think about communism, what's the end of communism?
Complete equality, absolute, a belief in no government whatsoever, the state withering away, etc.
There's no government. And that everyone is equally a member and participant in the life of the commune.
The law fairly.
Yeah. Instead of the government over people, the administration over things.
Well, if you assume that everyone is self-interested in craving their own power, is such a communist utopian vision possible? Or will it lead to the Mensheviks killing the Bolsheviks?
I mean, the Bolsheviks are the other way, right?
The Bolsheviks killing the Mensheviks. What Stalin or Lenin killing Trotsky?
Lenin didn't kill, it was Stalin.
Did Stalin kill Trotsky?
Yes.
Okay, Stalin killed Trotsky.
The point is that people kill each other.
Yes, the point is people kill each other. Well, what about democracy? What's the ideal of democracy? What's the utopian vision of democracy?
Is there any?
It's not far from the utopian vision of communism.
Depends upon who you ask.
Depends
upon who you ask. A chicken in every pot.
Well, I mean, we could probably come up with different ideals, but what really, you know, what's the purpose of democracy?
The diffusion of power.
Diffusion of power across the system, such that
there's no sort of ultimate authority.
But all people have a voice in the representative process.
Yeah. Right.
Equality.
Yeah. All people have a voice, equal voice in the system. Well, Niebuhr thinks that if we're creating power, guess what? We're going to change the rules to make sure that some voices are more equal than other voices. And we're going to make sure those rules keep us in that position of power. Does that echo with anyone's experiences right now?
At this point, that seems to be more and more so.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think when you see how Barack Obama operates, too, you know, he operates with a system where he recognizes that Republicans want what they want, certain Democrats want what they want, certain independents want what they want, and he's got to figure out how to mediate them. He doesn't want to diffuse them in a lot of ways. He wants to sort of control where they their rhetoric ends up, with him sort of popping up at the right time saying, okay, here's the solution. Well, if all political authorities ultimately are sort of affected by our self-interest and our desire for power, then all systems of government then are sin-filled. What kind of government is the best? And he thinks it's democratic. Probably not that much of a surprise. And he says this: humanity's capacity for justice makes democracy possible, but our inclination to injust makes democracy necessary. And he says democracy is the best, yet sinful means for human justice. And he sort of does believe that ultimately what has to happen is you have to have unions and capitalists. That in his vision, each of them is equal in power, such that they check each other. And he feels a democratic government is still ultimately the best. But the problem is that it will never be just. Justice is not possible. Equality is not possible. Because that's utopian. That's almost a messianic idea. And for Niebuhr, ultimately, it's God. It's our reality as images of God that gives us worth. And we're just going to have to do our best. And it's his model that, it's known as Christian realism. And it's his model that's often used to sort of make sense of our political institutions today. And frankly, the role of Christianity within it. What Christians should do then is become a powerful kind of lobbying group for the Christian vision and participate in the life of the democracy, knowing that this is the best we can do. And it's sort of defeatist, it's sort of pessimistic. He calls it realistic. But it really doesn't have, then, I think a lot of us, myself included, I mean, I believe the government is a force for good. I mean, we talk about education and healthcare and roads and our national parks. And I believe that a government should strive to bring about a just society. And, you know, Niebuhr is like, well, okay, but you know it's going to fail. Try it. Let's do it. But just remember, you're a Christian first. Does that make some sense? Any thoughts about his view? Or,
and so he really does go beyond Luther in saying the government's purpose is more than simply maintaining peace.
Yes.
He really does go beyond that.
He does bring up the language about justice,
yeah,
which Luther does not. Luther is not interested in justice in that sense.
Right.
I feel like I'm nitpicking here a little bit, but democracy and the republic are not the same thing.
That's true.
And representative form of government seems to really particularly be problematic. Because if you have a pure democracy, everybody in this room is involved,
sure,
in the decision, as opposed to picking you, the flawed, selfish human, to represent our interests. You know,
sure,
you go off, and your sinful nature has you sort of keeping power for yourself and sort of, at least psychologically, convincing yourself that you're serving us best by staying, you know, getting reelected 8 or 12 times. Can you speak? I don't know Niebuhr. Are we talking about representative?
Yeah, I'll give you one caveat, is that Niebuhr's brilliant, but he's not analytical. So these are direct quotes from his text. He doesn't really flush out exactly what he means by democracy. My guess is that he means representative democracy, because that's the world that he knows. You know, you don't read him as a political theorist. You read him as a Christian trying to make sense of what Christians should be doing in the world. and sort of how we should see the political authorities. So, yeah, I mean, I think that's a legitimate point. I don't think Niebuhr is going to provide much clarity on the concern, though.
I think that this makes a lot of sense if all of our individual selfishness checks each other, and we all have to sort of work it out. It gets a little bit muddier if we are relying upon Peter the representative to sort of check, who is our selfishness at a representative level, and the rest of us, sort of have to like.
Well,
sort of
he of course thinks that ultimately if you bring us together enough representatives, we're going to have that same sort of dialectic of power critique and such that it diffuses. But I think the big concern of his view ultimately is, and he was sort of pressuring him on this. I mean, a lot of his stuff he wrote before World War II, before the Holocaust. And what was the Nazi regime? It was utopia. You had the leader. And what was the leader there to do? Ensure the survival of the master race. And he was really, his later stuff obviously is sort of coming out of that too, but he's really worried about utopianism. That's his problem. Not really the violence of sort of the peasant's world that Luther was doing. Yeah, Kurt.
It strikes me that there's a chunk missing from this conversation. I think you're right to point out that certainly Paul and Luther, and you would insert Augustine in the middle of those two, don't sort of point immediately toward a sort of Christian progressivism, right? Like, I think that's apt. But I also think that Luther is fiercely democratic in some ways, just not about governance, right? I mean, his entire philosophy was based around people having access to scripture and people being the universal priesthood and all of those things, I think really are, in some ways, the sort of bedrock upon which sort of European and American democracy sort of comes eventually. I think there's a deeply sort of democratic tendency toward Protestant thought, Lutheran thought, and Protestant thought in general. But I think you're right that it sort of pushes us toward that precipice, but then says, ultimately this is second best, right? This is only pragmatic, right? At the best. But I in some ways think that reclaiming that is a really hopeful next step for our democratic process, right? Is that if we have on the one hand people, shouting that entering Iraq is the Christian thing to do, and on the other hand people shouting that universal health care is the Christian thing to do, that we're ultimately sort of impoverishing our whole dialogue. But I think the other aspect of Luther that I find really, really persuasive is his pragmatism, right? Is that ultimately we can make decisions based on what seems in our limited scope to be the good in the moment. It's hard to shout that from the rooftops, but I think it's an important sort of witness to this religious political moment in our history.
That's a good point.
Well, what about groups of people and organizations, Christians, for example, who band together and create parallel structures to the government? That happened with Solidarity in Poland, and I mean, it's happened in various places, even in this country. There's a need, something is not working, they create an organization or a system, which oftentimes has ended up having some pretty powerful effects mm-hmm. on local governments mm-hmm. and has really been an agent of change. And this has come out of this desire to look at the common good and what is Christ or Jesus or God calling us to be and do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm certainly not suggesting it's not possible. What I am suggesting is that there is a real there's a real sort of hole in a lot of Lutheran but Protestant justifications for government and working with a government. Partially because, in some ways, what's the alternative community? The alternative community that's above the political, it's the church. So you already have your sort of true citizenship. And as a consequence, everything's relativized. And yeah, I mean, it's important that you obey the laws. I mean, part of what the history and tradition of being Lutheran has meant and is that it meant that you were supposed to obey the laws of the Nazi state. Because really, where were you supposed to find your true sense of meaning and purpose? In the church. Which meant that you sort of locked the doors. And so it's a very world-averted perspective. And I think, you know, not all of us are Lutherans in here, obviously. You know, I am. And Holden was rooted in the Lutheran tradition. I think there's a real problem in the language and the theology. And we have to struggle to find the terms and really the sort of the robust Christian imagination about what we should be doing as Christians in the world. I mean, how do we support universal health care if that's what we believe in? If we believe that that's what it means to love your neighbor as yourself. You know, on the one hand, we have this text from Paul that tells us just obey the laws. There is due by God. You know, it requires work of us. It requires us to think and to come up with a theology that asks us to be involved politically. And it's certainly done. I mean, Sojourners is an example of that. The problem, though, I think, too, is it's done better by the evangelical Christians, who are clear about what they believe.
If not consistent.
We'll actually talk about them tomorrow. I found a pretty influential text called Christian Economics that has a whole robust attitude about, among other things, government and taxes. Dick, did you?
Maybe this is overly apparent, but in my thoughts, you know, the grandest difference is at Luther's time, the church had, in some respects, had a history of being a great governing body, if you will. Yeah, we had the kings, but I mean, they were an integral part of the ruling world. And so, as Luther is going through all of that and trying to find the faults and find the good parts, it's still, how can we continue to rule in a fashion that is still that God-led ruling? Whereas by the time you get to Niebuhr, after the formation of the United States, where it was a much more secular situation, it's almost like a member of the church trying to find the church's spot in a secular government, to say, you know, who do you want in your government? If there aren't Christians in the government, who are there? And since we are the best of the best, since we are given that authority by God, we certainly need to be a part of it. I mean, it's almost like trying to fit back into a government that has become secularized as opposed to continuing. Just some random thoughts there, and I, you know, that makes it confusing. Two different directions of coming at how we view our role in the process. Does that make any sense?
Well, yeah. I think you're suggesting that there's a very different context
between our world. Precisely.
I think that's exactly it. But the problem is, especially for those of us who are inheritors of the Lutheran tradition, we have this tradition that's been handed down to us with this kind of language and this theology. What do we do with it? How do we speak? How do we talk about loving your neighbor in a world that, in some ways, our neighbor is also the person who's making, you know, my chacos for $1 a day in Vietnam? You know, that's the issue, I think. you know, and how do we do it? And yeah, Kurt.
It strikes me though that secularism isn't an accident, right? Like that seems like a logical extension of this sort of sense that divine authority and the authority of governance ought to be separate from one another. And I'm generally in favor of that impulse, right? And the church ruling the world didn't work so well.
Yeah.
I'm not sure that that's in any way something that I feel like we want to move back toward. And I think that we have resources for that. And I think that the fact that we should be, you know, translating our religious ideals into ethical political speech, you know, makes a lot of sense to me within the Lutheran context. Mm-hmm. And if the line between sort of church and world, between God and world were a little more defined, you know, that would be more difficult. But I think that sort of circle of sort of theology to ethics to governance seems to be like something we have really strong resources for within the Protestant tradition that we aren't all that good about talking about in the secular context, but I think we can be better. I mean, I think we can be theologically grounded in a secular system in a way that, you know, the Catholic Church doesn't strike me as having the same resources for talking about.
I think that's a good point. Just sort of a tangential side note. The History Channel did they counted down the 2,000 greatest humans of the last two millenniums. Guess who was number two? Yeah, Luther. Luther was number two of the 2,000. And the
who was one?
What?
I
mean, actually
one?
Don't remember, because I was so shocked that Luther was number two. But in some ways, it goes back to what Kurt's point was, that a lot of political theorists and a lot of historians trace the development of Western secular democracies and human rights and dignity out of Lutheran theology, Luther's critique of the power of the papacy. Because what did he do? It's the priesthood of all believers. Everyone has a right to read the Bible. I mean, think about the implications of that. You have to learn how to read. You have to be educated. I mean, all these things that came out of his, and he, you know, he wasn't the first to do it. He was just the historical accident that it worked. You know, that the Frederick the Wise, who was the Duke of Saxony, protected him from the Roman Catholic Church, who wanted to kill him. They went after him, and by doing so, it sort of led to other protesting estates, which is where we get the word Protestant from. Because these political kings and dukes decided to thumb their nose at the power of the papacy, because guess what? They wanted their own power. But, and of course, that led to how many years of violence and conflict, which, of course, we talked about yesterday, led to political liberalism and the need to get rid of religion in order to maintain a safe and just society. Peaceful, not just. Any other thoughts?
It's also worth noting as a tangent that Lutheranism only survived because the papacy was fighting Muslims encroachment on European through Turkey. So
well, it was also
we owe our existence to
it's also going bankrupt because of the amount of money they were spending on St. Peter's and
But without Islam, Lutheranism wouldn't exist, I think we can say, with
Serge. Well, I thank you for your voices, and I'm sorry it took a little bit of time for us to get going. I can't say I'm a PowerPoint or virgin anymore, so I just had a sophomore slump maybe or something. But it's, 7:20, so we should just get out of here.